I read something somewhere, or maybe saw it on TV.
Maybe someone said it in a movie.
That everything in the world vibrates, trembles, fluctuates. It's some kind of mechanics. Molecules, particles, all the tiniest fractions of things aren't exactly where they are.
They move a little this way and that. Now, if something vibrates, it must make a noise.
Everything that vibrates makes a noise. Even an imperceptible noise is a noise.
And since there are 1,001 things in this world,
it's like they're all in an orchestra.
This is the Serpentine Podcast on General Ecology. On Saturday, the 1st of December, Serpentine Galleries held the second symposium of their General Ecology series, The Shape of a Circle in the Mind of a Fish, at Ambika P3 at the University of Westminster. It was part of their year-long project investigating how different disciplines, natural sciences, anthropology, humanities, cultural theory, and the arts, are all considering ecology and how we can bring these considerations together.
So if you'd like to close your eyes to start and nestle yourself in your seat, take a deep breath in.
This symposium was subtitled, We Have Never Been One. In our own bodies, we are outnumbered 9-1 by non-human cells. There are more non-human bacteria living in harmony with us in our own bodies than the cells that make up our skin, our stomachs, our brains. If we as humans need these organisms to function, are we even humans without them? I'm Victoria Sin. I'm an artist, and in my work, I like to think about the ways that we see ourselves, how others see us, and how these things affect the way we act and move through the world.
I assume you're going to edit this, right?
Yes.
I
spent a day at the symposium with my producer, Jesse, speaking to participants about their ideas.
So I've been thinking a lot about zooming, zooming out, zooming in, being big.
I wanted to know how concepts of individualization and collectivism influence how we construct our identities.
I'm like a 5'6" wormhole, just like time and space collapse.
I started with symposium curators, writer, researcher, and editor Filippo Ramos, and world-famous podcast co-host Lucia Pietro-Justi.
The Shape of a Circle in the Mind of a Fish all started with Lucia sharing footage of this little fish, of a puffer fish, that in order to attract a partner, makes this incredible geometric form, a circle, in the sand.
Yes, I've seen this.
And us imagining, we both look at this circle and we find it amazing. The fish clearly finds it amazing. What is it that brings us together? And what is the shape of this circle in the mind of a fish? And this was, so a little fish was the starting point for the whole thing.
Wow, that's beautiful.
Hi, Victoria. Lucia Pietro-Justi.
Hi, Lucia. Nice to meet you.
Hi, nice to see you again. And I am curator of a project called General Ecology at the Serpentine, of which the year-long symposium, The Shape of a Circle in the Mind of a Fish, is a part. And the other thing that I would say about that little puffer fish is also that for the fish, maybe it's a dance, and whereas for us, it's an image. So it was this idea of, like, how can a shape be both a dance and an image?
Yes.
And that led us to think about interspecies communication. And then, of course, there's a kind of interspecies communication that happens when you're trying to get people that work in different disciplines to speak with one another, sometimes even different scientific disciplines. So we felt like, I mean, the kind of joke was that we were sort of looking at interspecies communication, but we needed to do more interspecies communication between us.
Yes.
So that's the questions that drive us today.
Do you think, in a kind of everyday context, going through your life, you perceive yourself more as an individual or more as a multitude?
I perceived myself as an individual until I got pregnant. And then I realized that there were two brains thinking in the same body.
Yeah.
And that made me think, if we are the same body now, then technically we've always been the same body, like the starter of yeast. In Italian, the starter of the yeast is actually called madre, mother. Mm. It separates from, but it's always been the same yeast. So multitude since then.
And what I think is curious, and I think many people will get out of here thinking about this today, is that even our mind, our thoughts are so conditioned, traversed, occupied by the agendas, the needs, the desires of other agencies in our bodies, of bacteria, of microorganisms, that I think that the conscious of a self is maybe what needs to be redefined as a cluster of lives and of life forms. So I think that more than thinking, do I feel a self or a multitude? It's more like, what I think is a self is actually a multitude.
Sometimes referred to as a renegade scientist.
Someone who left science and still works with the topics of science. And
Phoebe Tickell used to work with bacterial genetics, algae, and a little bit of genetic engineering for biotechnology. She now works as an educator and consultant for organizations who want to become more networked and non-hierarchical.
And in a way, mimic nature. It's funny, like the fact that we used to be apes is in a way brings us closer to our, to like a, on a time axis, like a symbiosis with other species. But Darwin, you know, his theory of evolution and you know, competition and survival of the fittest, I feel it really bled into our culture. And, you know, there's this notion of nature red in tooth and claw. And directly on top of that, you've got Dawkins' work with the gene and the selfish gene. And
yes.
And then that really bleeds into our economic system of the way we see, you know, the way we see everything as competition. And I think it's also important to point out that it's not that competition is wrong or that it doesn't happen. It's just that it's not the complete story.
Yeah.
So it doesn't do justice to the amount of evolutionary novelty and development and progress that happens through networking, through collaboration, cooperation, blurring of species boundaries. You know, there's a species of bird that like helps alligators clean their teeth by, like, you know, like that they have this relationship where the bird comes and like removes the,
yes,
the bits of meat from the alligator's teeth. It's amazing to see this on video. And, you know, if with a Darwinian lens, you could definitely argue that, oh, you know, it's like a selfish move because it's like they're getting each other to help, you know, themselves. But it's just like the lens that we see.
Yeah.
These things happening. I think it's there are different ways of seeing the same phenomena.
Phoebe opened the symposium with a symbiotic meditation, encouraging us to understand our minds and our bodies as interconnected with the rest of the world.
So take a deep breath in. Make yourself comfortable. And just sense into the feeling of your body. And we're starting by focusing on everything that's solid in the body. So I'm asking you to think of your bones, of the solidness of your feet on the floor. The material of your bones, calcium carbonate, is the same material out in the world, of thinking of rocks. And the very same atoms in your bones are atoms that may have been part of bones of dinosaurs many, many years ago. And eventually this solidness, all of this rock inside your body, returns to the earth, and we're shedding skin all the time. Shedding bacteria, taking in new bacteria. So now let's think about everything that's liquid. The saliva in your mouth, in your eyes, in your nose. The mucus lining your throat, your stomach. And now think of all of everything that's liquid outside, the vast oceans and rivers, rains and clouds, water permeating in the soil, and water inside other organisms. The saliva of a sheep, the blood of a salamander.
And these water molecules on your breath that you're breathing in and out, they're the very same water molecules acted on by cyanobacteria 2 billion years ago, as they first converted water into oxygen, which allowed us to be here. And this brings us onto the element of fire. These tiny bacteria deep inside your cells are working very, very hard all the time to provide you with the energy that allows you to walk, to think. Millions of years ago, these mitochondria were converted from a free-living bacteria into the tiny powerhouse inside every single one of your cells today. They were engulfed, they were enslaved, they were kept captive, allowing you to live. If you focus in on the warmth of your breath as it comes out after you've breathed in, when you breathe out, that heat, you can thank the millions of mitochondria for keeping you warm. Now focusing into your heartbeat. This heartbeat has been a continuous heartbeat down the whole evolutionary chain of living beings that led you to be here today. When you were an ape, when you were a small mammal, a fish. And then think about the time when, before there even was a heartbeat, when you were just a cluster of cells, and then when you were just a single bacteria. And from that single bacteria, now a multicellular organism housing millions of bacteria, all working together in concerted action. We're really here thanks to cooperation. When we huddled as small mammals, when we came together as intricate and complex symbioses, engulfing bacteria, becoming chimeric, multicellular mosaics of beings.
That was the opening of The Golden Snail Opera, a more than human performance of friendly farming on Taiwan's Lanyang Plain, brought to the symposium by Gruff Theatre and anthropologist Anna Singh.
In the 20th century, both scholars and the rest of the public were dedicated to the idea that humans were so different than the rest of the world, that we should have completely different areas of study, where if we studied humans, we'd just study humans. Mm. If we studied non-humans, we'd just study non-humans. And this turns out to have been a rather bad idea, as we can see from all the environmental problems that came from ignoring how humans and non-humans are all wrapped up together in our world. And the more we think about it now, the more impossible it becomes to segregate humans as if they lived in a bubble by themselves. It turns out, indeed, that most of the cells in the human body are not human cells at all. They're bacterial cells, that we couldn't digest our food without those bacteria, that everything we do as humans depends on all kinds of other species, and not just to eat, as was imagined before, but in all kinds of ways. It turns out that most organisms are unable to develop into themselves without other species that help them become who they are.
So maybe there needs to be kind of like a collapsing of boundaries of categories.
I think that humans and other living things turn out
to have many commonalities that we haven't recognized before.
Yeah.
And that one of them that I'm really interested in working with now is the idea that we make history together, humans and non-humans. That I think I grew up believing that most other animals or plants or fungi evolved a really long time ago, and then they've just been the same ever since then. So they're just static. But it turns out that in human time, in the kinds of histories that we read about humans, all kinds of plants and animals are changing how they are, too.
Yes.
And that it's these common timelines that are so important for that kind of set of dangers to the environment that we sometimes call the Anthropocene, that these are the histories that humans and non-humans are making in common, often to the detriment of the livability of the world for both of us, that humans and non-humans.
Yes, so definitely. So we have to kind of like place ourselves in this kind of evolving narrative.
That's right.
Yes. And I wonder, this is more of a personal question, I guess, whether you kind of consider yourself as more of an individual or more part of a multitude.
I think that at every part of the society that I've been part of, we've been asked to be individuals, even where it's extremely detrimental. Mm-hmm. That in my own field of anthropology, for example, the neoliberalization of the academy over the last 10 or 20 years has made a huge difference, as scholars feel that rather than working in collaboratively, they ought to just be making a name for themselves. And the field gets really boring, and then there's no point to it at all. So to me, only the collaborative practice builds something that's worthwhile as scholars across generations, across all kinds of specialties.
Yes.
So that's just a tiny example of how it's really hurt us, I think, that the focus on every individual out for themselves.
Yeah.
We need to be paying attention to those who live on Earth with us, both human and non-human, that if we don't pay attention to the plants, the animals, even the bacteria around us, we're really going to build unlivable spaces for all of us. So if we want to keep some kind of social world on Earth, we have to be paying attention to all of those others.
Hello, I'm Victoria.
That seems very loud. Am I very loud?
Is it working?
Oh,
yeah.
Well.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
All right, okay. I was just asking how many of you watch Black Mirror?
I'm going to welcome our next two participants. Johma Moylema.
We good to go?
We're good to go.
So I'm Anaïs Tondeur. I'm a visual artist. I've been working with Germain Molmos, an anthropologist, since 2015, who work around soils in urban environment, exploring other ways to engage and develop an attention to these soils.
So basically looking at the history of soil sealing, so this history of hiding away the soil in cities, we think it's what you see as a negative in this history is the history of the creation of a kind of human modern subject that is supposedly disentangled from the environment, you might say. But a lot of what the engineers in the 19th century were trying to do was to make sure that the smell of soils wouldn't penetrate bodies and corrupt bodies and these sort of things. So it was a way of putting boundaries between people and all the other things in the environment, which nevertheless sustain their lives.
Mm-hmm.
So, our take on the multitude theme is about looking for conditions of emergence, conditions of existence, and all these things where, you can't really draw a strict line between what's an object and its environment, for example.
So you're trying to kind of like break down the barrier between ourselves and soils, in a way. Do you think of yourselves more as an individual or more as part of a multitude?
I'm trying to go back to this idea that, in fact, we are part of a cycle, different cycles of the living. And, I mean, we can't continue like this, being you know, outside of this whole milieus of life, and we're totally part of this field of relationship.
Mm. Yeah, definitely second option too. Was it the second one? Yeah,
yes, multitude.
But mostly just because I try to think of things in terms of milieu. So it's possible that individualities sometimes emerge or crystallize, if you want, but it's also always something very specific and temporary. So I'm not completely scraping away the notion. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I do think that you're made through encounters and things that happened in a historical move in life, basically, as you live.
So milieu is also a word for multitude.
Yeah. It, not exactly. It translates as environment in English. Oh. But precisely, it's not just the environment. You can have an individual in an environment, mm-hmm. but according to a certain understanding of milieu, you can have an individual in a milieu. The individual is a milieu because it's both what's outside, but also what's inside.
So it can be both at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. That's what it means, I think.
Yeah. And one last question. How do you think our perception of ourselves as individuals, mostly in kind of like a contemporary sense, has affected the world we live in?
Yeah, I think that this has participated in the silencing of all the other beings that are with us, around us, in us, that we you know, make the world with. And of course, that has huge ecological consequences today.
The kind of like modern understanding of our environment is just something totally silent, and it can scare you as yeah. well.
Mm. Yeah, another also. Mm. When you stop othering the environment, mm-hmm. I like that. It's less lonely.
Yeah,
that's kind of beautiful.
Scientist at Rockefeller, Leah Kelly, told me our very understanding of how our bodies work is reliant on non-human organisms.
Pufferfish are really important to me.
She uses toxins from pufferfish to help map the human brain.
I can't speak for all scientists, but I just think the fact that we're working with these organisms every day, I think there's just an inherent respect there and acceptance, and maybe it's arrogant to say so now in light of everyone saying, oh, it's a big shock that we consist of other organisms. But to me, I feel like, no, why would we have assumed that we didn't?
Mm.
It's about this commonality. It's about us using the same mechanisms and molecules to navigate life.
Do you think in your kind of like everyday life or your work, you consider yourself or you perceive yourself more as an individual or a multitude?
I've always felt I've needed context to tell me what I am.
Mm.
And you decide what story you tell yourself, and you do that on the basis of all the stimuli that's around you. I think that's why being in sensory deprivation is considered, you know, torture, right? Because if you don't have this input, then actually you don't have an identity.
Yeah.
So it's just it's a cop out maybe, but it's a dance. It's that tension. We exist. You know, I think that's what everyone's saying. You know, we exist in the tension.
Mentioned wanting to make this topic a bit more bodily.
Particles that leak out of a vessel and kill 20 cells deep.
I was thinking as I was sitting through the talks that we're having a bit of a therapy session. It's like a group therapy session.
And the sense of a multiplied or dispersed self is an occasional epiphany, which occurs briefly before you come back into your body and put the kettle on.
I don't even really know where I'm going with that, but... Yeah, sorry.
I hope this is making sense so far.
Writer Daisy Hilliard has just published a book called The Second Body.
I think that the book was an attempt to feel out the ways in which I am not the kind of singular, individual, self-interested being that I think probably I've been cultured to feel I am. So it's a book about this kind of process of learning in the ways in which, kind of piecemeal, the ways in which I'm not that kind of individual, the way nobody is that kind of individual, but also trying to confront with some honesty the problems you come up against when you try to experience yourself at a ginormous scale or a tiny scale. I don't know, do you kind of wake up and feel like you're a microbe, or do you feel connected to everybody in the world?
I mean, I think it depends on a lot of things about like what I'm going through, or this time when I took acid, I came to the conclusion that I was the kind of my experience and my consciousness was like a summation of all of my cells and bacteria like working together and trying to stay alive.
Yes, which sounds kind of right as well, doesn't it? Right, and it seems like people often have that, you know, that kind of hallucinatory experience can often be more correct than you know, you hear stories about people like losing something and then like on a trip 10 years later being like, oh, my car keys were in the, you know, I don't know, under the bonnet or something, and then you go and find them and there they are. It's like it's like a kind of realization of a knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. And I think it has to do with like perspectives, and like there are like experiences and sometimes drugs that you can kind of experience that will help you see things from different perspectives.
Yeah.
And I wondered if there are any perspectives or any experiences rather in particular that kind of helped you come to the realization of yourself as more than an individual?
God, I don't know. I mean, I suppose an obvious, really kind of like mundane one would be pregnancy, which I'll talk about a little bit here.
It's not mundane, though.
Well, it is mundane, and I guess that's why it's kind of this weird thing when you feel like, and everybody has that image from Alien so strongly in their heads, don't they? That there's this kind of other being that might be working against you rather than with you.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it is so kind of everyday, you know, you just see these people walking around with like other massive people visible inside them.
Yeah.
And it's like just this kind of really ordinary thing, you know. So that's the kind of thing, I suppose, that I want to dwell on, are these things that happen in real life but that we maybe pass over. We don't kind of,
Do you think that individualization is something that we kind of have to actively fight against?
At the moment, yes.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to kind of use too aggressive for language, but I do think that at the moment that's the kind of dominant image for the way in which we are experiencing things, and it doesn't really seem to correlate with the reality, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, there's a kind of like the history of, you know, like the nuclear family and how that served to individualize like nuclear family units. And then I've been thinking a lot about how social media, and especially like the forms of social media, like you have Facebook, which connects people, which has been kind of like superseded by Instagram, which is about kind of like putting out a self-image and putting out like a personal brand. We're coming down to like smaller and smaller units.
Yeah. What do you feel? Do you feel yourself as an individual, or is it?
I think a lot about my community. And I think a lot about, you know, not wanting to get old and be alone, but at the same time, I don't want to have a family in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
So I think about coming from a queer community, how we can kind of like grow and take care of ourselves in a world that always doesn't, that doesn't always take care of us.
Yeah. And that by doing something like that, you're remodeling what the family is, you know, and the more people can do that and create these other ways of being in a community, the more that just reshapes the definition and it opens things up for everybody.
In Daisy's talk, she spoke about the fluid and malleable nature of categories of understanding and how language should accommodate this. As someone who identifies as non-binary, this resonated with me strongly. My friend Travis Alabanza often speaks about the use of the non-binary pronoun they as being plural in order to contain multitudes of genders and intersecting complexities that make up one individual. I remember seeing a meme where, when confronted with someone complaining about the use of they as a singular pronoun, a non-binary person responded, "Well, I'm a man, and I'm also a woman. There you go, that's two people." I think that really, the discomfort people experience is with the complex identities, the multitudes that one person can embody. Right at the end of the symposium, I caught up with my friend Priya Jay. Priya is curatorial trainee at the Barbican and Innova, and a researcher interested in creating spaces she wishes existed. Priya had also been at the symposium all day, working on the production team. We caught up over a beer, and I told her about the conversations I'd been having. She helped me to contextualize them in our everyday experience.
Yeah, I think like these types of conversations, they can like take you out of contemporary realities in a beautiful way, actually. But then to pin it back down to current violences and current politics is interesting. And I'm reading Adrienne Marie Brown's Emergent Strategy at the moment.
Yeah.
And she talks about like, she looks at kind of biomimicry and the way that fungi or dandelions or flocks of birds move.
Yeah.
And one of the things that she said was, together we must move like waves.
That's and beautiful.
It's so beautiful. And it's part of this like longer paragraph. But I think when we talk about these like self-collective things that can just feel so like heartening and affirming, to apply it to political action or facilitation.
Yeah.
Of like, yes, we're all individual, but we're critically connected.
Yes.
Yes, we exist in our own bodies, but we're responsive to others.
Mm-hmm.
Is just such a generative way, I think, of
Absolutely.
Seeing this short time that we're all together.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, like, you say, like, pinning things down to, like an everyday real-life experience. You know, I think about like my experience as somebody who is like queer and who's not white, and the fact that like this kind of you know, I don't really have a choice in like being part of a being like individualized in certain spaces and then collectivized in other spaces. Like you get lumped together, and also you get, differentiated.
Yeah.
And I think that that's like so important to these conversations of speaking about ourselves as like multitudes and individuals, that there's like such a complex network of power relations. And that's something that I think is often missing in these conversations.
Yeah. I think that sometimes these conversations, especially when they can get to the very small or very big level, can become depoliticized easily.
Yes.
We talk about us, we descend to humans, but ultimately human power structures are so present in all of our conversations and in our lives as we think about different ecologies. And yeah, like you said, I think in queer, or when you enter spaces as a queer person, or we enter spaces as queer people, there is either like a very like expansive, like homogenizing of like, okay, you are the queer community, or it's like you are so like different from everyone around you that you become this like hyper individual.
Yes.
And yeah, I don't know, there's just, yeah, I don't know where I'm going with this, but
I think it leads to, you know, like you get tokenized in certain
spaces. Yeah. Yeah, I think multiplicity is so important to bring nuance. And if we continually think of multiplicity and nuance as being so key to understanding our experiences as complex beings and others as complex beings, I think we can help like always like unshift like dichotomies or binaries without doing it in like a forced way.
And allowing space for multiple kind of experiences, narratives.
Yeah.
For like this kind of multiplicity.
Exactly.
Of experiences within spaces which sometimes homogenize is important.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely. As humans, we tell ourselves stories based on our experiences with the world around us. Our job, then, is to seek out and pay attention to narratives which, for whatever reason, we cannot see. We have to do the work to center marginalized experiences that we can't immediately relate to, but which we undeniably have an effect on, both in human and non-human contexts. We cannot and have never existed outside of a multitude. That was the first episode of the Serpentine podcast on general ecology. I am the multitude that is Victoria Sin. This podcast was produced by Jesse Lawson for Reduced Listening. Thank you to Ania Lockwood, Vivian Kachuri, and Yeno Sotella, whose sound works have all been featured in this podcast. Catch up on our last series, the Serpentine podcast, on work at radio.serpentinegalleries.org or subscribe with your podcast provider.